Coming up next on Is It Just Speculation?
Всем привет, меня зовут Андрей Серяков, я физик из Санкт-Петербурга и занимаюсь столкновением тяжелых ионов, и я рад быть на этом подкасте, где мы говорим о коллайдерах, о теории симуляции и прочей ерунде интересной, как космос, например.
Hey everyone, it's Chris, the host of Is It Just Speculation, the podcast where we take a look at the gray areas of life, where things are not always black and white or as they appear to be. Today we're joined by Russian physicist Andrei Seryakov, who's a specialist in heavy ion collisions. One of the particle accelerators that he works at is actually the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which you may have been familiar with. Stick around for more information, and as always, check out the description for some links that we talk about during the episode. Hey, Andre.
Yeah, hello. Hello, Christopher.
How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
Yeah, I'm always worried when we do episodes with people from different countries because the distance kind of messes it up sometimes. So it's good to hear. Are you in Switzerland still?
No. I'm in Russia because the CERN is closed for Christmas. So you need to leave it. You can't stay there.
Okay.
Usually I'm staying there like for maybe two, three months per year. So I'm here there. There is no need for that.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a great project of you as a hobby one. Totally support it. Good to go.
Yeah, for the for the podcast.
Yeah, good to do science communication as a hobby.
Yeah, that's why I was so excited when you were able to join. I always like getting different perspectives. I think you might have saw that I had Marta, I think, is a mutual friend of ours.
Yep.
And she was really great. And I love getting perspectives from just outside of our country because our country can seem a little bit constrained sometimes because it's hard to get an outside perspective when the United States is so big. So I'm sure you can relate being from Russia.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially because the United States is very self-oriented, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. I'd agree with that. So if you want to tell everybody about yourself, who you are and what you do.
Yep. So my name is Andrei Seryakov. I'm from St. Petersburg. This is the second capital of Russia. And I'm doing heavy ion physics. So this is relativistic nuclear physics. So this is it's about collisions of different nuclei with particular speed of light. And what we do, we recreate conditions which existed right after the Big Bang. So first microsecond after the Big Bang, and we create a new state of matter, which is called quark-gluon plasma, and we study how it behaves. It's a complicated subject, and this matter is very dense and hot. It's about 10 to 15 degrees of Celsius. And in fact, we study products of decay of this plasma because it's too hot and it's too unstable. So this is my science part. I'm also a science communicator. So I give a lot of lectures about Large Hadron Collider, particle physics, dark matter in Russia. In Russian language. So I had a blog for like 5 years about particle physics too. Now I'm a bit tired of it, so I don't do it for last year probably. Maybe because of the COVID and all this stuff.
I stopped doing that.
And yeah, I'm an outreach coordinator of the SHINE experiment at CERN. So I do some visits there. So in case you in Switzerland, you come to Switzerland, you should definitely visit CERN. So you even can go underground if LHC is not running, because if it's running, then there is radiation. So you can't anybody
in this time.
But if you're there, definitely should go. But there are also other places to visit at CERN, like antimatter factory, and yeah, another experiments, exhibitions, and so on. So I'm a guide at CERN. I'm not just organizing visits, I'm doing visits by myself to Shine and to other LHC ones, Alice and Atlas. So yeah, that's probably everything. I mean, and I do also some small stuff about science communication. I did have a podcast too, but only five episodes, I even don't remember. And then I was appointed to be an outreach coordinator of this experiment, and I had complete lack of time, and I decided to stop podcasting.
Do you do your podcast, or whenever you were doing it, was it English and Russian? Did you mix it in?
It was in English mostly. So I had only a single episode on Russian, and how many? I don't remember. I have four episodes. Yeah, I have four episodes in English. It's called Born to Science. So it's even probably available somewhere on iTunes. This episode is still available.
I can post a link in the description so people can go listen, because there are some good episodes on there, some good topics. So definitely worth listening to.
Yeah. Some of them are pretty complicated, I would say.
yeah.
But some episodes are... for example... Antarctica is a very nice one. I really like it. I even want to go there. One about dark matter, but that's more for physicists, maybe.
Okay, so you know, this is a complicated subject that you are involved in with physics. What led you to pursue physics, and was it science fiction inspired, like a lot of other scientists usually are?
Yeah. nothing special about that. I started reading. Yeah. I was like 7 years old, something like that. I was particularly 8 years old. So my teacher was pretty surprised. Then I brought these books to her. But she didn't stop me from that. And I was reading, I'm still reading science fiction. And probably I realized that these technologies you are reading about are very far away from the current state of humanity, our technology. So you cannot go to, even cannot go to moon. I'm not speaking about other galaxies. Yeah. So yeah. Somewhere around age of, I don't know, 13, I decided that we need to change that. And I realized that we have really lack of technologies, and I went to physics because I wanted to, I don't know, to develop something, to create some, I don't know, to discover some new laws which will allow us to travel for long distances. That was my childhood dream. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I was good in math, and I'm still good in math and physics, so it was pretty easy for me to do that.
Yeah, and you have over 50 publications, if I'm not mistaken. What would you consider to be your most, you know, not impressive, but your favorite finding that you were part of, that you can say, you know, this is the work that I did and I'm proud of it?
Well, I mean science. I don't know. I mean, at the end, I'm doing stuff which is pretty far away from space traveling and space by itself. So I'm studying how particles interact and all these things. So we discovered this, this call it onset of fireball. We found that to create quark-gluon plasma, you need to create some kind of the collision. So we usually collide some heavy elements as lead ions or gold ions. They have around 100 nucleons and protons inside. So, but if you go to proton collisions, then it appears that you don't see a quark-gluon plasma there because it is too small amount of matter. Mm-hmm. And we will analyze.
Usually
there is a small chance to create it still, but it's a very small one. So, but we went to study other systems. So I was studying beryllium collisions and argon collisions. And we found that beryllium collisions is pretty close to behavior of beryllium collisions. The system which is creating beryllium collisions when you collide them with speed of light is closer to, by these properties, proton collisions. And beryllium has seven protons and neutrons inside, and argon is around 40. So, and argon behaves closer to heavy system as lead. So it means that somewhere between beryllium and argon, there is something happening. There is some kind of transition which allow to create. It's a bit complicated, but that's what we are doing in my experiment. We are studying when and with which conditions with argon plasma can be created.
So what would you say is the main reason for knowing what the answers to those experiments are? Because a lot of science seems to just be building on the previous science work that's been done to understand more of the universe and more of how everything works. But at the end of it, let's say we get all the answers. I mean, what does it matter? What's the point of it all?
I don't know. I mean, for us, it's more about curiosity. Yeah, so it's very interesting to know what is around the corner, what is hidden there, how it's working. So I think it's a complicated and a good question, and I'm afraid I don't have an answer. What happens if we know everything? I don't think we will be able to reach this point. So it's not some kind of asymptotic. I have to think about it. I can't give you a fast answer. Sorry for that.
No, you're okay. I feel like it's kind of, and I in a very, very weird way related to like a religious belief where you can never really know until you supposedly die. And then, like on the same side of the science thing, there's always something else to explore. Even if we discover everything that we can find in the universe, maybe there's, multiverses. So there's always something else beyond it. So I just thought, what would your point of view be on the science side of things?
That's the only point of view of a scientist. It's only about curiosity. Yeah. So it's sort of fun doing that. But I think in terms of humanity that we develop, so this is the way we go forward. This is how we stop stagnation, because if you stop doing any research, if you stop doing any investigations about how things around you are happening, then you have to stagnate, because it means that you, I don't know why, what would happen that we stop be interested in things around us. So this is probably something, some kind of part of our nature.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing, because I would hate to think what the world would be like if people were not trying to push what's already been done. I mean, we would still be living in the Stone Age, basically. So I definitely think it's a good thing that there's people like you out there kind of pushing what we already know and figuring some new stuff out. With the projects that you're involved in, you mentioned SHINE, and I know you have some other projects you're working on. There's multiple countries that are involved, and the project's so dependent on being accurate and being detailed, because I know there's a lot of data. How do you bridge the barriers between countries, whether that's through language, culture, or perspectives? Because I know there's got to be a lot of different points of view from different scientists, from different countries, just based on who they are and their experiences. How do you kind of bridge that gap?
So I don't think that this gap is a problem. It's really an advantage. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many sides of it. But just looking at CERN, how it's functioning, this is very I don't know how to call it, like horizontal structure. So it means that there's no like much verticality there. A lot of collaborations of individual groups which work together, and there is no much hierarchy there. So we came together because of our will, because we want to do that, and we work in very effective way. You can judge it just by looking how LHC is working. It started working right from the beginning, and we were no any like major problem with it, and still going, and it will be going for 20 more years probably collecting data. So it's a huge success, and the same for other scientific collaborations. I'm mostly working in pretty small scientific collaboration. This is Shine, and we have only 150 people there. That's very little. And for example, Alice, where I also take part at the LHC, but that's not my main experiment. We have there around 2,000 people, and it's also not the largest one. So there are even larger collaboration around 4,000-5,000 people, and from like most of the countries. And you know that the web was developed exactly for this aim. So like World Wide Web was developed at CERN in 89, if I remember, in 1989, all this. Web pages, I even give images, even them. We developed a CERN exactly for scientists to communicate, for scientists from different countries to be able to exchange data between each other and effectively build all these huge setups. Yeah. So, and because of all these different backgrounds, we can do these huge projects. There is no country in the world which can build a large Hadron Collider alone, even USA, even China, no country has an expertise for everything, for all technologies which are involved. So you have to create an international project to make such science working. So it's not enough to have a lot of money. Yeah,
and I think a big point that people would be aware of is the International Space Station, where it's multiple countries working together on something that's really, I mean, very complicated to be living in space continuously for, you know, decades. So I'm sure people can relate other countries working together in that way, even if they're not familiar with the particle accelerators necessarily.
I'm not familiar with space station. I mean, it's really based on this Cold War technologies, and it was like collaboration between Russia and the USA mostly. They built it, but of course it was a collaboration. It was great success that we were working together on the same project.
Yeah, and up to pretty recent, Russia was the one that was giving our astronauts rides to the space station. So, you know, even after that initial collaboration, we're still working together as a pretty recent. So I feel like that's a good example of, that collaboration you're talking about.
Yeah. But that's a bit sad story for me as a Russian.
Yeah, it's, I'm sure there's some, what are your thoughts on that? Because I know it was, you know, Russia kind of leading the way for a while, and then we had to rely on Russia. And now it's a little bit different with SpaceX. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy that SpaceX was founded. I mean, like 20 years ago, situation was pretty sad because nobody was really aiming to do any space flights. Cold War was over, and politicians were not really interested in that. I've heard that Swiss space station was won the Congress in USA. Like they decided to build it in favor. So there was like a huge chance that we will know International Space Station because they decided that there is no point in doing space research after Cold War finished. So I was pretty happy, and most of the people I know who are interested in space, they're really following SpaceX or other space companies, and we're really proud of them as a humanity because we really want us to be in space and in Mars. A lot of people still dreaming about that in Russia. We have it in our culture. So all lectures about space, they're really popular here. Children still dreaming to be like cosmonauts or astronauts. So it's a great thing. But another side is that, unfortunately, our current is not one which favors innovation. It's more about conservation. It's more about past, not about future. And that's why all our innovations, they are really slow and have a lot of problems, stoppers on the way, and everything controlled by government. And the technologies we have in space, they are mostly based on ones developed during Soviet Union period. We made them better.
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that something really new was created. That's a sad thing.
Yeah. I am glad that they are making improvements overall, because like you said, there's those really three main companies, at least in the US, and I'm sure there's other companies around the world that are trying to do the same thing. But I mean, the more people that go out there, the more likely it is that we're going to, you know, push that boundary, which is that curiosity.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good thing. Yeah, I'm really happy that all these companies were created, because now they force my government to make steps forward, not to be in the same state as we were for like last 30 years, to develop new things and to at least put some money in this field. Yeah.
Alrighty. So what is the SPS? I think it's a super proton synchrotron. And how does it differ from the one that most people know about, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider? What's the difference?
Yeah. So LHC, it cannot function alone. So we need to have an accelerator chain you cannot put a proton inside LHC, push a button, and it's like accelerating. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you need to already, so we're usually talking about energy, not really speed of protons there. So energy of particles at LHC is around 7 tera electron volts. So electron volts, and mass of the proton is around 1 GeV. So it's 7,000 times mass energy is m dot speed of light squared. You probably know this formula. Everybody knows that. So you need to put there already protons which have around 400 GeV energy. So, and only they can be accelerated at LHC. So to do that, you need accelerator chain. And this accelerator chain, you may also put a link to your description, because that's a thematic link, because it's a bit complicated. You need to have several accelerators, from really small ones, like several dozens of meters length, to large ones. And LHC is 27 kilometers. This is the main ring. And the second ring is SPS, superproton synchrotron, which is 8 kilometers. And there is also proton synchrotron, but I don't remember what is the length of that, but smaller, even smaller for than that. And there is smaller ring and so on. So I'm working. So we need, but we're also doing science at SPS. And the thing is, if you create a quark-gluon plasma at the LHC, you study phase transition between more ordinary matter and quark-gluon plasma. I didn't tell you what quark-gluon plasma is. This is a state of matter where quarks and gluons can freely moving around. So usually in the normal matter, quarks and gluons, they bound together by the state of three in protons and nucleons. So this is an ordinary matter. But if you melt them, if you make a very, if you heat them a lot, like 10 to 15 degrees of Celsius, you have a new state of matter. It's like, and there is a phase transition between normal matter and quark-gluon plasma as a phase transition between, I don't know, ice and water. So to study that transition, you need to go to lower temperatures or to lower collision energies. And that's why we use SPS to be able to reach this region, to be on this border between quark-gluon plasma and hadrons. So we can change energy of collision, and at one point we may collide something with low energy and there will be no quark-gluon plasma at all because temperature is too low, and we just increase a bit energy and then this transition happened and we see that, that there is a quark-gluon plasma.
So when we talk about colliding the particles, what is the actual process of getting the particles used in the particle accelerators? Because you know, I don't know if anybody's ever thought about it. I'm sure they have, but I've never heard the actual answer. Like, where do you get the particles from? Like, is it literally just shaving off pieces of, you know, lead or gold, whatever it is? Or how do you do that? Yeah.
So first of all, there is a different procedure for protons and lead. Mm-hmm. So for protons, in the past, I will explain you how it was done in the past because it's a bit more simple than they do it now, but it's easy to understand. So you have how to get a proton? You just get. You have to take. I forgot how it's called in English. The first element in Mendeleev table. How it's called?
Hydrogen.
Yes.
Thanks. Okay.
Yeah, so you take hydrogen gas, and hydrogen atom is just a proton and an electron. So you just need to ionize it. So you use some high currents, and you strip all these electrons from their orbits, and you have protons. And that's okay. All. Now
you can
accelerate them with electric field. So you have a linear accelerator, you put them there, and they accelerate there, and then you have several circular accelerators, and you finish with LHC.
Okay, that makes more sense. I told my wife, do they just order them on Amazon, like in a pack? Like, how do you get the protons?
Yeah. So for lead, it's a bit more complicated, or for gold, doesn't matter. So because there is no lead gas around us, so we take a piece of metal, just small, like few centimeters length, and then we heat it to high temperatures so that it start to evaporize. And then again, after you having a vapor of lead, you just strip all the electrons from it. At least most of them. You're trying to by different technologies, by using electric currents or special foils, because it's more complicated to remove 82 electrons from orbits than to remove only a single one from proton. We do that and then they filter, we filter them to remove all atoms which still have. And then it's the same, we use a linear accelerator and several circle ones.
Okay. Yeah, I like that explanation. I've never heard it explained. It's always just, you know, get the particle and get the other particle and put them together. So I like your explanation of it. How difficult is it to actually ensure that you have a proper vacuum and that the electromagnetic and the electric fields and everything with the detector are in sync? Because you are spending this enormous amount of time getting the things that you need ready, and then you're doing the collisions. But how do you actually make sure that all the, you know, the whole machine, basically the whole chain of things, works together at the same time that it's supposed to? Is it pretty complicated, or is it pretty
it's
reliable?
It's a lot of science put there. Mm-hmm. So I'm not right kind of scientist to speak about that because I'm studying collisions, but there is like a special field of science which are working on design of accelerators and developing new ones, and we call them like accelerator scientists.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated because you have these particles moving with speed of light, and like for example, LHC is 27 kilometers long, and you have, I don't remember, like 10 to 15 protons circulating there with speed of light. So each proton's going around this collider, how many? 10,000 times per second. So that's a really huge number, huge frequency, and a lot of particles. So everything have to be tuned well. And this collider is so sensitive, I mean, this machine, that it feels how heavy trains are moving in Geneva, like 20 kilometers from the collider. So because all these small vibration, they affect beam inside. So if you so you have to simulate this, yeah? So you have to simulate, is your vacuum is well enough for beam particle to travel there. And after all your calculations, you know the value of vacuum, because there is no perfect vacuum. You cannot create a perfect one, but you some kind of can have a small mixture of particles there. And you can measure that. There are like different detectors of which measure what is the pressure there. And yeah, but if something went wrong, if you have if your vacuum is not high enough, then you just see it because your beams, your particles will start to interact with all this, I don't know, dust, which is or molecules of air, which is still in the tube. So okay. You will see it pretty fast, because all these interactions produce radiation, they create a lot of particles, and you catch them by radiation monitors, which just placed around the LHC, like each 10 meters, there is a special monitor which detect these particles.
Yeah, and you mentioned simulation. I had a question. If supercomputers become advanced enough where we can run simulations like you're talking about, but you know, on a bigger scale, doing the whole particle simulation, basically the accelerator, if they get to that point where they can be replicated, the experiments to be exact, and at the fraction of a cost where you don't have to spend resources and you can do it in, you know, much higher quantities because it's just a simulation, does that eliminate the need for a physical experiment, or do you still need that physical experiment?
I mean, I can create in my computer how like my neighboring apartment looks like, but if I've never been there, I will never be sure that I've created it right. Yeah, so that's the same with particle physics. We're already on the stage when we can create such model. We do have a lot of, we call them Monte Carlo generators. Late particle collisions at any energies. We're working with them on our daily basis, mostly to understand like detector effects, how detectors effective and all the things. So we simulate how our detectors working, how particles travel through. But even if we have a perfect agreement, we can't be sure that it's work properly on another scale of energy or with rare processes, because if we don't check it. So, okay. Yeah, so of course I can simulate anything in my old computer. We have, we can simulate universe already with supercomputers. But if you don't have astronomy, then what is the point? We will never be sure that that's right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just to kind of use it as a tool to make sure that you're at least on the right track, and then you can run the experiment physically and make sure that it actually is, you know, what you are expecting it to be. Is that kind of what it would be used for, just more as a tool?
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. This is, I mean, because there are not really many things which you can check on paper. I mean, by writing some formulas and all this stuff, because it's so complicated. There are so many different processes happening there. So it's really hard to take one and study it. You need to study effects on that process of different other complicate things which happening around. And to do that, you need to build like a huge model, which include all these effects. And you can turn on some of them there and see how it change, how like your results change. And by seeing this tiny difference, you can really, and comparing it with an experiment, which what we see in experiment, you really can understand, is this tiny process happening or it's not there?
Okay. So the particles that you've talked about a little bit before, they so far only last for short amounts of time because it takes so much energy to create them, and they just basically disappear. If they could be extended and collided with other exotic particles or with each other, is there likely an even deeper level of exotic particles that we can probably never get to?
So that's a bit tricky one. So for example, there are projects of colliding unstable particles. So there is a project which called muon collider. So this is a collider which collides muons. Muons is a heavy electrons which are unstable, but they can travel for hundreds of meters before decaying.
Okay.
So there is such a project, and it's really can create some interesting results. So you need to have particles which interact with these newer particles. So for example, imagine you have a particles which interacts only with Higgs bosons. For example, this is one of the famous ones. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And with no other particles which we know, which we have around. So then to study that part, to create this particle, you need to particles which we have in a way that they create Higgs bosons or maybe even a Higgs boson. And this boson, for example, decay to these new particles, which not known for now. So you somehow need to have this intermediate step. Of course, it's for example, this particle, new particle interacts with, quarks, which we have in ordinary matter, then it's much easier to create it.
You can create it
with small probability, of course, but still. So to have a particle in a collider, to accelerate it, you need this particle to live long enough. So probably muons they live long enough for us to make this happen. There are also pions. This is unstable particles, unstable states of up and down quarks, or two quarks, up and anti-down, for example, and we collide them. But they are not really exotic. These particles, which are well known. Exotic particles, this is heavy quarks, as for example, charm quark or beauty quarks, which are much, much, much heavier than ordinary quarks, or Higgs boson or other like W bosons, other particles which are heavy, but they are really stable. So there is no point we can accelerate them because they live a very small amount of time. They travel small distances. They even, like most of this heavy stuff, is even can be detected by us. So we catch products of their decay. For example, for Higgs boson, then we say that we detected a Higgs boson. It doesn't mean that we detected really this Higgs boson, but we found a lot of signatures that there is something which behaves as a Higgs boson and it decay into particles which we caught. And by looking on these particles, we see these signals, and we believe and we think because of our different models that it's Higgs boson or top quark. That's the same about top or double wave boson or other heavy particles.
So how confident are we that the particle accelerator detectors actually see everything that we're looking for? Is there a chance that there's something that is being created with those energy collisions that is not being picked up on the detectors?
So we always study that with some probability. So with Higgs boson, 9.999, I don't remember how many nines are there, but that's, we're pretty sure.
Yeah.
And it all depends on what is the probability. So this is quantum mechanics. So there is, if for example, you have a problem collisions, there is a probability to create a particle, like a given particle. And this probability can be very high. For example, it's very high probability to create a pion. Pion is, again, a state of quark and antiquark, up and energy down, for example. And protons and neutrons, they build from up and down quarks. So there is no problem. And you always have these pions created in any proton collisions. So, but for example, a probability to create a Higgs boson is pretty low. I don't remember what was the number, but it's, I may be wrong here, like, but it's probably around like one Higgs boson per, I don't know, maybe billion of collisions or 100 millions of collisions, something like that. So it's pretty low, but we did that. But if, for example, there is a particle which can be created only once per, I don't know, 10 to 12, like hundreds of billions, yeah, or thousands of billions, it may happen that with such machine which we have at LHC, we need to collide particles like hundreds of years to create a single particle we're looking for. Yes, there is such chance. And we can't really be sure that there is no such thing. And of course, if you create a single particle which decays instantaneously, it's not enough to even see it. So you really have to create like hundreds, thousands of such particles to be able to distinguish it from the huge noise you have, because from other collisions. Yeah, there is no point you cannot tell in advance, will you create such particles in your collision or you won't.
So how does machine learning help sort out that massive amount of data? And how much data are we talking about?
Whoa. So we're talking usually about like LHC collide around 100 millions of protons, 100 millions of protons per second. It will even be, frequency will be even increased soon. So, but of course, most of them are not stored. So we are talking about dozens of gigabytes per second.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a lot of data created and stored and then analyzed. Yeah. So I don't know, like, they definitely use machine learning more than they distinguish good events, like we call collisions events.
A single event
is a single collision. So good events from which we want to store from ones which we don't, like interesting from boring ones. So interesting are stored and boring ones, they just happened. And they use machine learning algorithm for that, so like filtering events. But we also use a lot of machine learning for other detector techniques. For example, to reconstruct tracks of particles. If particles go through a particle detector, it's, for example, through pixel detector, it's probably the easiest technology to explain. You have like several layers of pixel detectors, but they tuned not on photons as the pixel detectors in our smartphones, but on charged particles like electrons. And so you just have many layers of pixels. And if particles go through, these pixels fires up and you see a lot of these dots in space. I mean, your computer, in fact. Yeah, you can't see anything by eye. But your computer, and now you have to run so-called reconstruction algorithm to make a particle trajectory, to draw particle trajectories through these pixels. And that's also where machine learning algorithms are very helpful.
Okay. Yeah, I can imagine it to be a lot of data, so I'm sure it's easier than having a bunch of humans look over the math.
Yeah. So for such things, it's a some kind of engineering one. Yeah. But we are really cautious about using machine learning algorithms for understanding what is happening in collision, because in that case, machine learning algorithms is always a black box. You don't know what's happening inside. I mean, I'm talking about neural nets. I'm talking about like trees with like decision trees, which are easier. But if you have a neural net, then it's a black box. You don't really know what's happening inside and why it draws such conclusions. So it can be used to guide our eye, but we can't use it to make a final conclusion about physics happening inside. So we really need to understand. We want to understand what is happening. We don't want algorithm, a black box, to tell us, okay, that's happened. We want to understand why and how.
All right, I like that. I feel like there's always that human element to all the experiments that you've been talking about so far. So even though we can simulate it and kind of get a best guess, I like that you follow up with the actual, you know, human part of it. How limited are we, even with the relatively massive particle accelerators that we have, given that, you know, compared to other celestial bodies, they're pretty small. But also when you think about the universe at the very beginning, it was a lot more condensed up into, you know, basically a single point within the, you know, early part of the universe. So are our particle accelerators big enough because it used to be a small universe, or is it too small because the universe is so big? Like, how does that factor in for you?
So when we talk about particle accelerators, we also can think about them as because they can recreate conditions which existed in the first moments of our universe.
Yeah, it's hard to put a time to it. I was going to say the first few seconds, but that's not even.
No. I can put a time. I'm just talking about particle. You can put a time. I can give you a picture with all these times drawn, and you'll put a link after we record it.
Yeah, so, I appreciate that.
And this connection is happened because our universe expands, and by during expansion, it's cooled down. So our current temperature is around 3 Kelvin. So it's minus 270, something like that, to 270 degrees of Celsius. This is the temperature of photons, which and whole space is filled with them. So the only difference between matter, which exists now, and matter existed like, I don't know, 1,000 years after Big Bang, is temperature conditions. So that's the same physics, same particles, but density and temperature are very different. So, if we want to study how it behaves, how this matter with such conditions behaves, how universe behaves, we need to recreate these conditions. We can't go there. We can't look there in the past because universe was not transparent. It was so dense that light was not able to travel through. So we can't look there through telescopes. So we need to create it in laboratory. And LHC is a tool to recreate these conditions. And we recreate conditions at LHC, which happened at the first microsecond after the Big Bang. Okay. And we already did that for all time after that. So with low energy accelerators, we already studied how matter behaves at 1 minute, at 1 minute point after Big Bang and so on, after 100 years after Big Bang. But we can't go closer to the Big Bang than 1 microsecond for now. So to be closer, we need to build a larger experiment, larger collider. And that's, there is a project to build one. So it's new, still not approved by Europe. It should be approved at the end of 20s. So in like next probably 5-6 years, and it will be 100 kilometers collider. And with that machine, we'll be able to go closer. Because there are still a lot of mystery moments after Big Bang. For example, why everything around exists. And not, I mean, just because in all our collisions, in all our experiments we do, we see that matter, antimatter is created in the equal amount. So if we create two particles, then we create two antiparticles. There is no way we create a particle from nothing. We need to create antimatter simultaneously. But what we see around us, we see that universe is made out of matter and there is no antimatter at all. So this is a riddle. This is one of the biggest mysteries of the universe for humanity. And so it means that something happened at the first moment, even earlier than first microsecond in the universe, which broke with symmetry. So somehow in this symmetry between matter and antimatter was broken at the first moment. And then it's restored, and already after in 1 microsecond it was restored, and we see this 100% symmetry between matter.
So this is
why we exist. We need to go closer to the Big Bang.
Is the current thinking that at the very beginning, when there was matter and antimatter, that the only reason that we have matter as it is today is because it outnumbered antimatter by just a little bit, and it basically just went out. Okay.
So I have a number. So it's, I mean, I found these calculations. So per 10 billions of antimatter particles, we had 10 billions plus one matter particle.
That's all it takes, right?
Yeah. So, and all these 10 billions annihilated right at the beginning, somewhere at the beginning. And only this one per 10 billion particle survived, and now it's whole universe which we know from all this little amount of particles. But why this symmetry was broken, and how, and why this one piece out of why we had a bit more matter than antimatter at the beginning, we don't know this answer, because everything we do on LHC and other experiments, it shows that we have to from pure energy, we can create only the same amount of matter and antimatter. But and we believe that right after the Big Bang, we were only pure energy, and we all matter and antimatter were created from pure energy.
Isn't that the whole point of entropy, that you can't have that symmetry?
Oh, I don't know how it's connected.
Hey, that's a good mystery to have. That keeps us curious for sure. So, that's a good thing to keep on working at. You see here, would microgravity in space and the amount of open space be more ideal for a particle accelerator if it was possible? Or would the condition of space be too harsh? Not even mentioning the repairs you'll have to do for the accelerator itself.
I mean, the problem is cost, money. Mm. So that's not about conditions. That's everything is about money. Has really low budget compared to other fields. And I mean, as a humanity, we don't have enough resources to build an accelerator in space. But why don't we build a bigger one? Because science doesn't have money. I always compare it because I read lectures for Russians, and I compare the price for LHC with the price for Olympic Games, for example. Mm-hmm. And LHC cost is around, like, total LHC cost around $12 billion per like 30 years. But Olympic Games, like Sochi ones, which happened in 2014, they cost Russia $60 billion. So that's a huge amount of money, and just for one game, that's for like 2 weeks. I don't remember how Olympic Games.
Is it a little frustrating to have to rely on money when money is, I mean, really nothing when you think about it?
Yeah, but this is the world we live in. Yeah. Yep. And this is what we are doing. This is why I'm talking about that to people, explaining them that we spend a lot of resources on different entertaining events, but we don't really spend them on science, on something for me, which is much more important.
Yeah, I feel like a good comparison would be what the entire world and every country has spent on COVID so far. If they were to apply that same energy towards anything else, I mean, imagine what could be done. I like to think of that, but also it kind of makes me sad to think of it because we could be doing so much more if we just put all our resources together. But we're in the world we are.
We have a chance with climate change to really put our resources together, but it doesn't work well for now.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on two common beliefs among casual observers of science and some physicists between the beliefs of string theory and simulation theory or holographic theory? They're kind of the same, but a little bit different. What do you think about those kind of thoughts about how the universe works?
So that's different theories, of course. String theory is something which was very popular like 10 years ago. So it's becoming less popular now. And the problem with it, because it's operating with such so small objects as strings, that you can't check them on experiment. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there is not a single string theory, but there are, I don't know, hundreds of them. Yeah, because with different parameters, with different dimensions, different lot of stuff. And there is no, and we don't think that we'll be able to test string theories in the nearest future. So when you're doing a string theory as a physicist, you stop being a physicist. You become a mathematician because everything you're doing is not connected with experiment, is not connected with things which can be tested. And the crucial thing about science that it has to be tested. So that's probably why it's becoming more less and less popular to study string theory. So you can talk about string theory, but as we can't prove it or disprove it, I don't think there is a point, because there are still many things which we don't understand on a much larger level, like with matter antimatter symmetry. And it may happen that our understanding of this small level will change dramatically I'm pretty sure it will change in this century, and we will not need string theory, or it will be completely different theory on such scale. So that's probably my answer. So I don't think as a physicist, I wouldn't do a string theory. As a mathematician, I probably will. because it's a beautiful, theory. Yeah,
you can be wrong if you can't test it. So it might be fun to be.
So why not do it for fun? I mean, right. I mean, it's like math working. So they usually investigate it just out of pure curiosity, out of pure, how it's beautiful, how all this. All this
the theory of everything
working together, but it's probably not connected with reality. That's the problem. So
what about simulation theory? Because I think that's probably the more popular one today, especially with, you know, the Matrix, the new one coming out. I feel like a lot of people just stick to the simulation theory because of things like the Matrix. What are your thoughts on that?
So I will explain. So simulation theory is more like a philosophy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not a scientific theory, as for example string theory. If I remember correctly, it includes three statements. First statement is that if there is a state of development of technology in which we no, that's different.
Is it the idea that if you can simulate, like if we can simulate a whole universe, then the chances are another civilization could have done the same, and kind of by chance or by, you know, probability, we would probably be one of those simulations. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. So it's a bit, I mean, it's formulated a bit more complicated way to be, it's like correct one, but yes, idea is that if we have this level technology that we can simulate, and we're interested in simulation, because now we are interested in simulation. You like look around on all these games we have or other stuff. We really, it's really a lot of fun to simulate a universe with your computer. And because all this huge computational power we have, so if you have even higher computational power in the future, and we can simulate a universe. So it may happen that to simulate a universe is much easier than to create, for example, to simulate a living being. I would say that's the way. To simulate a living being is much easier than to create a living being. And to simulate one which will not understand that it lives in simulation. Yeah. So in that point, you will instantaneously have much more simulated living beings in your computers than they exist in your planet or in the universe. That's because it's much more easy to create. So, and if you live in such a universe, then there is just being is very high and that your real one is very low. So that's like this way. But that's like philosophy. So
yeah.
I can't prove or disprove that. Yes, I agree. I agree that if it can be reached, then there is a high chance that right now we live in simulation. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, let me ask you from a mathematics side of things, if the universe was a simulation, how would you try to disprove that it isn't?
I don't think we can. I don't think we can disprove that. All these videos on YouTube, they're not really proving anything. If you can simulate any level of your understanding of universe, so then you can disprove it. Mm-hmm. And if simulator has infinite computational power, and it may have infinite compared to our current computational powers. Yeah,
it's interesting thought for sure. So
it's like an interesting mind exercise, I would say.
Yeah, I feel like you can go into a real rabbit hole if you start thinking about that kind of stuff. So better we don't. But appreciate your thoughts on it, because I feel like having a, you know, physicist, somebody who's grounded in mathematics and, you know, being able to test for things, having your perspective on that is appreciated.
Yeah, so to test anything, you need to have a theory which can... which makes some predictions, and these predictions can be tested. For example, problem with string theory is that the predictions of these theories cannot be tested with current technologies. So, and for example, if you have a simulation theory, like a real theory, not just some philosophy, and this theory has to make some prediction about universe, and these predictions has to differ from predictions of like other theories. So, and that's where you can distinguish one theory from another, which is true and which is false. But I've never heard about any such theories from simulation point of view, from the simulation side, because again, it's for now, it's just philosophy.
Yeah. So part of being a science communicator like you are is obviously reaching out to people and explaining some really complicated things in simpler ways. What did being a repeat Science Slam winner mean to you? And can you tell us a little bit about the Science Slam?
Yeah, so I've heard that there are such competitions in the US too. It's a bit different. So it's originated in Germany. In probably like 15 years ago, something like that. So this is a competition of young scientists, which gives short lectures, like 10-minute lectures with jokes in a bar, in a club. And there would be like six, for example, scientists, and they all give such 10-minute lectures, and it would be 5 minutes question.
After that,
the winner is one which has a louder applause from audience. And this audience is very broad one, so it's just people who are interested in coming. So they're not scientists. In Russia, that's usually like young people, students, and maybe IT people who are usually interested in knowing more about the world. Yeah, so I want to, I know several such competitions in Russia when I was like less experienced science communicator. So that's more for newcomers.
Yeah. So you're also a guide at the LHC. What does that entail as a guide? And is it a chance for you to practice those science communication skills with people from all over the world?
Oh, I mean, you're practicing it every time, and now we are speaking, and I'm practicing it too. Yeah. So in to be a guide at LHC, you need to work there, and you need to pass some security training, not security, safety trainings, yeah, because there are a lot of different detectors, and a lot of, like, there are really high currents, there are a lot of gases there, so there are a lot of things which can put people in danger who are not experienced, so you need really to follow them. And yeah, that's probably everything, and you need to be passionate about things you're doing to be able to talk about it.
Awesome. If there were no restrictions and you could design your own experiment, what is your ideal experiment that you would want to do that you could make a big change in?
I don't know, because I already can't do that. I'm working in such experiments there. We can easily manipulate our detectors and create one which we want. So I don't think I have an answer. If I would already have a project written, and we would be doing that in like 5 years from now.
Hey, that's awesome that you can make it happen. I feel like a lot of people.
It's not fast. It's not fast. I need to find fundings, other people to join me, and all this stuff. But in a few years, if all these technologies already exist, and if all these detectors already created, and they just need another configuration, maybe another particle, like beam of our particles, and if it's not expensive as creating a new collider, then it can be done pretty fast in several years.
So do you speak other languages, or is Russia English your main thing?
Plus.
I'm sorry?
And programming languages, nothing else. No. I'm not good in languages at all.
Yeah, I'm not great at them. I'm still trying to learn some German. Very like basic, like I can say is on the left or on the right, basically, and that's about it. So I'm with you on that one. Before you wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or anything else that you'd like to share with us?
No, I mean, I hope that it was interesting for everybody to listen to us, and I'm happy to talk about all this stuff because they're really exciting. And in case you want to come to CERN, in case any of your listeners want to come to CERN, so there are COVID restrictions, but after pandemic. So you need to contact somebody before coming to organize visits inside. So you can't just come because, I mean, you can, but there is a cool exhibition, but nothing else. You can't go inside to experiment areas because you have to organize it because of different safety reasons. You have to find a guide and all this stuff. You can contact these experiments. There are links. You can, for example, if you want to visit Alice experiment, you can contact, you can find them. You can find Alice webpage. and write to secretary. You can write me, and I will also direct you to so people who may help you. So, and probably then CERN. It's CERN open days.
Days,
maybe 2-3 days where CERN open everything for public. Last one happened right before pandemic in 2019. Like 80,000 people from around the world visited it. And
was open. So
I was a guide, not just the LHC, but also guide to the tunnel. Usually you can't go there because this tube where you exclude particles is filled with liquid helium. And if there is a leak, it's operate pretty fast and just remove all oxygen from the tunnel. So so we can't let people go there usually. But during this period, we removed whole helium from there and it was allowed. So the next open days, so we only start running in June. So probably first collisions, like interesting collisions, will be happening the collider in June since 2018 because we had a long upgrade period. So for next open days, we have to wait till this run finished, and it will be around 2026. So I would expect that in 2027, put this date in your calendar. So it will be probably September of 2027. Then CERN opens outdoors to public just for a weekend. And that's probably the best time to visit CERN.
Yeah, hopefully by 2027, the pandemic will be over. So we'll see. Sure. Alrighty. Well, Andre, I appreciate it. This was interesting and very educational. And I hope, you know, you had a good time as well. So
yeah, I was happy definitely to be here. So thank you very much.
Hey everyone, thanks for sticking around for the episode. If you enjoyed this one, be sure to check out the other episodes as well. And if you do want to support the podcast, there's a link in the description where you can click see more, and it'll take you down to the bottom where you can see a link that says support this podcast. If you click on that, you can support the podcast with a donation of your choice if you want to. And if not, that's okay as well. As always, listening, sharing, that's the best way to support me. So feel free to do that if you can't put in a donation. Thanks, everyone.